And I'm very excited today about where we take this conversation next, building on the podcast interview that we've already done. So set this up for us a little bit in terms of your thinking around logic models and what you've been doing in that area with the schools that you serve.
So, well, first of all, Justin, thank you for having me back on. I appreciate it. It's always good to see you. You know, so about a year and a half ago, I was starting to work on the book on instructional leadership here, and going through a lot of ideas. It was actually probably out of any book that I've written, it is the quickest book to ever come together because I was that passionate about it, and I found myself getting inundated with questions when I was on the road. So I started to put together basically four ideas around instructional leadership. One was knowledge dimensions, or a focus, what I call a focus for learning. The reason why I did that is because I'm pretty much on the road every week, or well, before the pandemic, I should say. And a lot of leaders were talking about what do we look for when we're doing walkthroughs or learning walks. And I coach a lot of leaders, so I walk around with them as well. And then we started focusing on things like student engagement. What does that look like? Research from Otitello from the 70s. Alienation. Our students feel alienated for one of two reasons. They don't feel an emotional connection to their school or the teacher, or they don't feel like they have a voice in their learning. And then I was tying together instructional strategies because of, you know, lots of people that I work with, and I geek out a lot when I'm talking about instructional strategies because I look at them like plays in the classroom, and I find that very exciting. And of course, I was going to focus on efficacy, but not collective teacher efficacy, because I focused on that a lot, but I wanted to focus on school leadership efficacy. Because with all the issues that we face, especially now with equity and our, you know, sort of the societal issues that we're seeing, why is it that so many leaders don't feel comfortable talking about those topics? And that's one of efficacy. So I wanted to focus on that. So I sent it all to John Hattie, because John and I are always going back and forth. And John said, you know, I think you need to talk about implementation more, because I had implementation sort of in each chapter. He and this guy, Stephen Cox, who owns Osiris in the UK, who I work with quite a bit. And they said, I think you should have a deeper focus on implementation, and you should start looking at a program logic model. So that long-winded story is where this came from. I have seen program logic models. They've been around for a long time. I'm certainly not the first person to introduce them, but they were all very complicated for me. And I'm a former elementary guy, and I just felt like I wanted something a little bit simpler. Because I think that there's a lot within simplicity, and this is where these five steps that you see on my screen come up with.
Yeah, I appreciate your comments there on simplicity, because, you know, we seem to be attracted to things that are complicated, especially as solutions to complicated problems. But I think where we often lose people is in the lack of clarity around our message and our rationale. People say, why are we doing this? Does this conflict with that other thing? The core simplicity there really is to me one of the big strengths of being able to articulate a logic model. So do you want to take us just through the basics of what we see on the screen here of this?
Yeah. So you can have a lot of pieces and parts, but I really came down to five. So explain each one of those. Number one, obviously, is your needs. Where do you want to improve? Vivian Robinson out of New Zealand, somebody that I admire greatly. And I've gotten to know over the past few years. She talks a lot about the fact that we're always talking about change, and we need to stop talking about change. We need to actually talk about improvement. So where do we want to improve? What is our current reality? Where do we, you know, where are we? Because we all might be in different places depending on the school or school district we're in. And what does our evidence show us? I'm always going to ask about evidence, because I feel like so much of what we do in education is always about that gut feeling. I just know it, right? And I'd rather, you know, over the years when I've been running workshops, I do a competency-based approach, because I like when participants can come in with the evidence to show where they are. It's non-judgmental. And I need to say that from the very beginning. I take a very non-judgmental approach to running workshops or whatever it is I'm doing, because you're in a different place and that needs to be respected. And whether you know as much of me as me or more than me, I don't want to get into all that stuff. I want to know exactly where you are, and I want to know the evidence that you've collected to see it. So that's going to be where we find our area of improvement. Now, there are really two ways. Oh, yeah, Justin.
Can I jump in with a clarifying question there? Because I particularly like the fact that you've used the term evidence rather than data. Why is that specific? What do you mean in that distinction when not calling it?
I think that I have post-traumatic stress disorder from being a school principal in New York State. And data was always a four-letter word. And I think that, you know, over the years, most people know that I work with Hattie. Over the years, we really have talked about using the word evidence. And I think, I don't know, maybe I needed to reboot the whole idea. But for me, evidence just sounds much more user-friendly. But it's a personal preference.
I share that. I feel like with evidence, we're on the hook for making a claim as well, right? The evidence is in support of a particular claim, a particular explanation or story about that present reality. And I feel like sometimes data lets us off the hook for that working theory.
I would love to tell you that I thought about it that deeply. I think, as a writer, I appreciate words a great deal. And I think I have certain words that I stay away from, and data might be one of them. But evidence is definitely something that I've always been fond of, because you're right. I would prefer to, if I'm going to say something is working, I want to be able to collect the evidence to show that that's actually happening. And it shouldn't be, this is the thing, you know, I've written about collaborative leadership, and as a school principal, I was very collaborative. As a teacher, I was collaborative. So all of this is about, let's get together and engage in dialogue, not about who's right, who's wrong, all that kind of stuff. It's really about where are we meeting to talk about the improvements we want to be able to make. And as we go through this, you'll see where, even though it's very simple, it has forced the districts and even some ministries of education who are using this, and states, to sort of have a deeper conversation about some things, albeit activities. So that's one of the areas. Now, when people are going through the program logic model, there are one of two ways that they can go about doing it. They can jump to the other bookend side, which is the impact side. And they can say, if we were going to actually work on this improvement, what would be the ultimate benefit to students and teachers? And so sometimes depending on the school districts I'm working with or the people I'm talking to, they like the idea of jumping to that side because they want the immediate understanding of how this is going to benefit students and teachers. Other times what you can do is just go in a linear fashion, and you can go right from needs to inputs. Now I'm going to show a few examples, you know, after this. So this is just sort of the clean copy that I offer up. But inputs are really about the resources you need to meet your goal, whatever is necessary. And this could be there are a plethora of resources, but I want people to actually think about them, because too often they think they have to reinvent the wheel. And this part of the process gets them to understand that maybe they're doing something already that's working. Maybe they have a connection to something that's working. So resources could be anything from a research-based article or a blog to going on YouTube and going to experts on YouTube about how to use things. It could be instructional coaches. You know, instructional coaches can be a very valuable resource. It might be leadership coaching. So you can plug pretty much anything into inputs that would be a resource. I often will tell participants in a workshop model or who I'm coaching that they really need to be able to put down time in the input as well, because time is that factor that people of all we say they don't have enough of. And we need to acknowledge that by putting that in where the input side is. And that's a really good thing to talk about. Where do we spend our time? What does that look like? In the middle are activities. And activities are the things that we're going to do to help us meet our goal. When I was a school principal, I flipped my faculty meeting starting about 2012, something I've talked about quite a bit in the past. flipped faculty meeting is an activity. Many people talk about going on learning walks or doing walkthroughs. That's an activity. And too often, that's an activity that doesn't have a lot of depth to it because people don't know what they're looking for when they go in, or they don't ever have a follow-up conversation with teachers to talk about what was really happening. So that's an activity that will help us meet our goal. And then the fourth part is where we look at outputs. And that's where we begin taking actionable steps. And the interesting thing about this one with outputs is that people often ask me, why did you put outputs? Like, what's the difference between an output and an activity? And when I, you know, over the years, I've done a lot of reading. And when you read work around change, you know, what does change look like? Change theory, all that kind of stuff. What the research shows is that we spend a lot of time in a pre-contemplative state of change. You know, we're going to eat healthy. We're going to go to the gym and start to work out. And then 2 years goes by and you haven't done any of it. Outputs are where we begin taking actionable steps, where we say things like, in October, we're going to start flipping our faculty meeting, or, you know, in January's PLC, this is where we're going to start having this discussion. It forces you to start talking about taking an actionable step. And what we know, especially when we tap into things like our societal issues, is that we can keep talking all day long, but if we don't take an actionable step, it's not going to do anything. And then last but not least, of course, is impact. What is the ultimate impact that we want to be able to have on students and teachers? So I feel like I've talked enough. So Justin, questions or any questions coming up in the chat? How do you want to go about this?
Yeah, and let me again invite everyone who is here to ask questions in the chat. And if you'd like to come on video, this is a round table as much as we can make it so online. If we were together in person, we would have our seating physically as a round table. So jump in here. What are your thoughts on logic models? How do you see these pieces operating in the improvement efforts that are underway in your organization? Peter, one question I have to kind of kick things off here is around the idea of an improvement or a program being sold. So let's get into the familiar situation of a district leader or a senior school leader going to a conference, maybe a conference where they've seen you speak, maybe a conference where one of our publishers is a vendor, where there are lots of different providers of different programs and interventions and improvement efforts that are being sold. When we buy something like that and bring it in to our organization, where does this fall on that chart? What kind of thing are we buying when we bring something in, like a school improvement program?
Yeah, so this is often where I would try to go about using that program logic model approach, right? So whether that's part of the problem, actually, Justin, is that, you know, when I first started presenting, I was still a school principal. So I was focusing on things that I was doing within being a principal. When I became a full-time, you know, consultant and author, what I started to see is a lot of those one-day kind of gigs where I come in, I talk about collaborative leadership, and then I leave that day. One of the things that bothered me the most was that I started to notice that people would say, you know, I do visible learning, or I do instructional coaching, or I do collaborative leadership, but I never really got a deeper sense to what that meant. And at first, it's pretty gratifying when they say they're doing your work. But then you start to think, how are they doing it? What are they doing? Like, how does this look? And that's when I created the competency-based model. I mean, I took the competency-based model that, you know, universities like Southern New Hampshire University uses. Now, since last year, when I was starting to work on the book, one of the luxuries that I guess I have, the place where I'm fortunate, is that I can take these ideas and I can use them in the work that I'm doing with districts or in workshops that I'm running. And I almost get instant feedback into whether they're working or not. So there's numerous ways that you can use this kind of program logic model. Number one, if you say you're working with me on instructional leadership and what does that look like, then the first thing we're going to do together on day one is go through a program logic model. I need to know where you want to improve. And from there, I need to know how I fit into the equation. How can I help you? When I'm working with leaders that I coach, and there have been a few districts, a couple in California, that I've been working with over the past 2 to 3 years, I use a program logic model approach with them because I want to understand where is it each individual each individual leader wants to improve, and then we use a program logic model to go through there. I think that much to what you were saying too is something that I found when I was actually working with the district in California. I noticed that the principals were suffering under the weight of initiatives, and they probably had about 17 of them when we did a workshop one day, and they were listing them. And when I met with the district directors, because all of those initiatives were coming from the different district directors, I actually put the district directors through this process where we went through a program logic model together. And it was the first time we had worked together as a group. When we got to activities, they listed all the activities, those initiatives. And then what happened is we got to the impact side, and I said, I need to know where your initiatives are having an impact on student learning. And one of them honestly looked at me and said, oh my gosh, we do a lot of activities, but we don't have a lot of impact. And I said, yes, you're activity rich and impact poor. And as I left that district, I was like, oh, I think there's something there. So I wrote a blog for my Finding Common Ground blog for EdWeek. I wrote a blog called, Are You Activity Rich and Impact Poor? So those are the things, and those are the things that I think are necessary for school districts, because much to your point, I think what happens is that people go in and they see a speaker and that they've always wanted to see or whatever, you know, and they listen, they're like, we're going to do that. And then they go back and they don't even talk to the teachers about it. They just start moving forward. I think that happens with things like learning walks and walkthroughs. We're on Twitter. We see that our friends are doing it, and man, we need to be able to do this. And then we start doing it to teachers without even involving them into the dialogue about what that's supposed to look like. This is a process that's supposed to help with all that dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely. Matt says in the chat, initiative overload is a real thing, and mentions a school district in California that did a great job of really paring down those initiatives. But yeah, I mean, that was kind of my hunch in asking that question, that as district administrators, as senior leaders, we tend to buy activities for everyone else to do and forget the cumulative kind of burden of all of those past decisions that really create some bottlenecks, especially at the level of principals and kind of key teacher leaders.
Yeah, and I think the onus is on us as the writers or the developers of the professional learning to be able to say to districts, maybe I'm not the one you need to be working with. Over the years, I've had people that have connected with me because they read the blog and they're like, hey, we want to work with you. And my first question is, why? Why do you want to work with me? And they'll start talking about an issue that they're having where I don't have any level of expertise whatsoever. And I'll say, why do you want to work with me? And they're like, because we love your blog. Well, the onus was on me at that point to be able to say, I'm not your guy, but I can give you a name. I can give you three names of people that you might want to look into because I think they're better suited to do the work. So I think that much to your question, the onus is on us to not just be the ones presenting on an idea because we're going to talk about how great it is. We also need to be able to talk about the challenges that people will face as they're trying to do it and try to figure out that. And also if we get the phone calls to say, we would like to be able to work with you on whatever that example might be, if we're not the best person for that job, instead of fake it to make it, you need to be able to find somebody that's going to be much more impactful. So I think there's dual responsibility there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I felt that, you know, that moment of kind of moment of truth of being in that position of being kind of brought in and then realizing that what administrators were currently being asked to do was actually in direct conflict with what I was about to say, and realized, you know what, we're going to have to have a pretty honest conversation here. You're telling me all these things you're doing, and I'm frankly about to tell you should do the opposite of those. But sometimes we realize that those conflicts have not really been confronted, so our frontline leaders and staff have to kind of figure out what to do with this kind of conflicting advice. So I wonder, yeah.
No, that's a great example. I want to give you an example of how I actually used this program logic model last summer. So I was working somewhere for 2 days, and I had worked with their districts before. There were probably about 90 school administrators in the room. I had worked with them before, really great place. But on day one, and it had been months since I had worked there, I was starting to run the workshop around instructional leadership. And every time I would ask for like audience responses, I was doing stuff like, can I do Kahoot? I was just trying to get somebody to breathe and like say, hey, I have a question. And finally, after a couple of hours, it was painful. And I even said, this is painful because I'm not here, like people aren't talking. So somebody came up to me and said, yeah, we're not going to talk. We're probably not going to share ideas because we've been slammed before. And, you know, we're worried about talking because some of the district administrators are in the room. And I was like, okay. And then they said, you know, we just found out the other day that we have an achievement gap where there are African-American boys. And I said, wow, was that like new news? And he said, no, we've known for about 20 years, but for some reason they brought somebody else in to talk to us about it. So I actually went back to the hotel that night, made it through the day, went back to the hotel, worked out, and then thought, okay, I need to use the program logic model. So the very next day they came in and I said, here's the deal. And I brought up two of these program logic models. One was, you have an achievement gap with your African American boys. And I said, but I'm not the first person to tell you that because you've known it for about 20 years and haven't done anything about it. So let's talk about what that might look like. And honestly, I heard a few people say, wow, he's going there. And I said, I'm not done yet. So the second one I brought up, and I did this very respectfully, but this is the deal. I can't be somewhere and see such a glaring issue and not bring it up in a discussion. So the second one said, you have zero trust between your district office and your buildings. And I said, now we need to run into an activity where we're going to flesh this out and start talking about it, or else you're never going to be able to move forward. And it doesn't make sense for me to even continue. And they did an activity for an hour and a half that I put them through. And we really fleshed out what the issues are, the trust issues. And I used the program logic model to be able to show how that happens. And I swear to you, that's exactly how it looked. Was I nervous about it? Yeah, about 5 minutes before we started, I was like, well, I could get kicked out of here really quick, but I felt like it was necessary to be able to do it. And I used this as a guide to show what that looks like. And it seemed to work out very well.
Good deal. Well, let's get into some examples specific to the pandemic and virtual and hybrid learning. We've had some questions about that. One comment I wanted to make just before we jump into that, because this is coming up a little bit in the comments, but you said in the upper kind of left-hand corner of the diagram, what is our present reality? And when we were talking about the achievement gap and achievement gaps that have been there, have not really been discussed, have been known, have been discussed maybe at that level, but have not really been addressed in a very long time. I'm reminded of, I think it's a Peter Drucker quote along the lines of, or maybe a Deming quote, well, somebody will have to correct me on that, that your system is perfectly designed to produce the results it's getting. You know, if we can predictably, forecast what our results are going to be for different groups of students year after year, it's because we have a system that is designed to produce those results. Maybe not designed on purpose, but designed by the culmination of all the decisions that we've made to address and not address that that situation over the years. So I like
And that's one of the things that, so I start a new show on Education Week tomorrow called A Seat at the Table. And Tom Guskey is going to be on tomorrow to talk about grading and assessment. That's one of those examples that you were just mentioning. In a couple of weeks, I'm gonna have Zaretta Hammond on, who talks a lot about equity and actionable steps. We're going to talk about institutional racism, white privilege, those kind of things. So those very things that you were just talking about are some of the ways that we have designed for that to happen within our schools. And that's why I think efficacy is such a huge issue to be able to address and focus on, because, you know, I did my doctoral work in how well school administrators safeguard LGBT students. We know that, you know, the Supreme Court decision yesterday in the LGBTQ community. the problem is there, if a leader doesn't feel comfortable talking about those topics, meaning they don't have the efficacy, the confidence to be able to do it, they're going to stay as far away from it as possible. So efficacy is part of that greater story where we're talking about putting a program logic model into action, having deep conversations about what are we doing and what marginalized populations are actually suffering because of it. So definitely something to be able to get into.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, with that, let's get into virtual and hybrid learning, because, you know, we've been making a lot of decisions as a profession based on what we have to do, based on the constraints. And I'm very excited to talk about, more of a proactive what do we intend to happen kind of approach. So take us into that.
Yeah. So the first week of March, I was on the road. I was presenting in the UK and then California. I came home and boom, my life changed, just like everybody else. Everything was getting rescheduled. And for a couple of weeks, I sat around the house and did some work projects. But then I started to think, where do I fit into all of this? I was a school principal for 8 years, but not during a pandemic. So what does this look like? What can we do? And I actually started going to Facebook. And that's important to talk about because it's in the input section. But one of the things that I found is that I was on Facebook and a couple of friends invited me to two pandemic pages, teaching during COVID, teaching during the pandemic. Combined, they have over 200,000 members. One had 140,000, the other has over 60,000. I was struck by the fact that within days, that number of people converged onto a pandemic page. And one of the things that I saw that many of you saw, many of the people here today saw, is that there were deeper conversations online, thoughtful conversations. People had more time at home, so they're spending more time replying. So those pandemic pages actually became very important to me because I kept going back to them. And we're talking several times a day. So what I started to do was I pulled quotes very objectively, because at first some of the quotations seemed sarcastic, others seemed very deep. And I thought, you know what, if I'm going to do this the right way, I need to be objective and just start pulling quotes and putting them into an Excel spreadsheet. There were over 950 comments. And what I started to do was code them in the instructional leadership language that I focus on. So things like implementation or knowledge dimensions or focus on learning, student engagement. And what I found is that the very things that came up on Facebook for issues that teachers were facing with their students and families were the same exact issues we have within an in-person situation. They feel different because we have less control. I wrote about it in a blog called 6 Reasons Why Your Kids Are Not Showing Up Online. That got hundreds of thousands of views within a few days. And that opened up some really neat experiences for me. So what I noticed is that not only are we going through the stages of grief because teaching is different now than it used to be months ago, but we're going through the situation where we've got no control. So school districts went to a no harm grading policy. Well, all of a sudden kids weren't showing up and teachers were like, I don't know what to do. Because in the past we've been able to use grades as an incentive or to hold over your head. Elementary school taking away recess, or even the peer-to-peer positive relationships where if Justin's doing his work in the classroom and I'm Justin's best friend and I'm a little bit, you know, not as engaged, I'm looking over at Justin and thinking he's doing it, I should be doing it too. So that positive peer pressure, all of that was gone. And so there's this really interesting time for us during this pandemic time, where we are seeing that the adults have a lack of control. And I need to think to myself, what I started thinking is, why do kids come to school if not to learn? If they're coming for the grade or whatever else, I get the peer relationships and all that stuff. So that's where all this is coming from. I have then moved on to do student surveys. I've surveyed over several hundred students, 4 different countries. And then I surveyed teachers about their pandemic experience. And it's a pandemic teaching experience because remote teaching takes time and reflection and to make sure we all have the proper tools. So I surveyed teachers about their experience as well. And I've received well over 600 surveys from 11 different countries. So that information I then took to put into this, because I'm working with numerous districts right now through a webinar format where my usual, you know, 7-hour workshop day is now three 2-hour webinars. And what I needed to do was be able to take all that information and then just start adding to it. Like, what does this look like? So under needs, what we know is that in the spring, all I kept hearing is that we're in this pandemic teaching experience. But at the same time, people are saying, we're worried about students, you know, losing what they learn and all that stuff. And I'm like, then we need to be able to move on from the pandemic part of teaching to more of a remote or virtual teaching. So then we started to notice that in the fall, no matter, you know, there are countries, like Thursday night, I'm doing a workshop for Australia. There are certain states in Australia that those kids are back at school and others that are waiting till the fall. So all of this, knowing all of this, is about how do we take that pandemic experience and turn it into a virtual experience. Now, kids have very defined ideas of what works for them and what doesn't. And during the instructional leadership work that I'm doing now with districts is that we focus on what are the students saying are the strategies that actually work for them. And they've been very powerful. And I've written a couple of blogs on those too. But then it's about what are the inputs? Honestly, I keep going back to the Facebook pandemic pages. And why? Because they're a common theme. If you start to read them from day one or two when that page was put together, you saw the stress and the trauma that people were going through. Now what you start to see is, what are you hearing about the fall for you? Are you all your, you know, it's like those conversations that we want to discuss are being discussed on those pandemic pages. So they give me insight into what those look like. Research-based articles. Now, over the past couple of weeks, I've seen some in Australia that I've read, I've seen some in the UK, and I've seen some in North America, where there are researchers looking at what this looks like. But one of the other things that I looked at and what I've added to my presentation is that PricewaterhouseCoopers actually did a survey 2 years ago that showed 10% of teachers who were surveyed said they felt comfortable using technology to offer deeper level learning experiences to their students. That was 2 years ago. So knowing that, there's no wonder why we're in this pandemic mood. Instructional coaches are starting to find their way. I'm working with a lot of them. What does this look like from a remote teaching experience? I've even, with some districts, I've started doing remote learning walks. So I give them an example of what remote teaching might look like, and then we discuss, if we were sitting in on that class from a remote experience, what might that look like? So instructional coaches, we've been able to do that. YouTube experts, quite honestly, running webinars, running virtual workshops, getting used to Zoom and doing breakout rooms. I bought a desktop first time in 7 years. I go to YouTube because I bought Adobe Premiere and it is way over my head. So I'm doing a lot of YouTube video, like watching a lot of YouTube videos on that. And models of successful practice, because there are districts that are actually doing really well. I matched up my former district with a district that has been doing really well where remote learning is concerned. So it's been good camaraderie that way. But activities, you can see them all. Kids are asking for flexible schedules or timetables. So when we look at the hybrid approach, when we look at all those different things. Madeline Will from Education Week wrote a fantastic article that I've read 3 times so far called 6 Ways to Bring Students and Staff Back to Schools. So when you're looking at flexibility and schedules and timetables, students were asking for office hours. I wish my teacher would have more office hours. You know, the communication home. I spoke to the director of technology for the Atlanta Public Schools and her name is Aaliyah, and she was talking about the idea that her superintendent was doing Facebook Live events every other week for parents. And then my editor at Ed Week, Elizabeth, was talking about how people were exploring the idea of looping. If we got to know our students in third grade, then we loop with them and we go up to fourth grade with them. And that helps with the relationship piece. And it also, for those teachers and students that feel like, oh, I lost that important contact with them in March, And then they're now closing out the school year and they feel like they've just, that major part is missing, that closure. The idea of looping actually helps them understand that they will be able to get that back. And then of course we have things like outputs. And like I said, they're an actionable step. So when you see things like starting next week, we're gonna teach content in one Zoom meeting. I started using things like reciprocal teaching during Zoom meetings because I think people look at some of these instructional strategies and feel like they're only good for in classroom, when the reality is they can be equally as powerful from a virtual standpoint. So we need to start looking at those same instructional strategies that I focused on in instructional leadership. How can they work in a remote experience? And I am actually using those in my workshops with school districts. So then you can see the office hours, Facebook Live, and then through engagement, we can continue to move from pandemic crisis teaching to more of a virtual learning experience. So that's the way to be able to use those program logic models. And what you plug into it is like professional learning. I heard that a lot of professional learning was geared toward how do you use this technology tool. Well, we need to remember that it's more than a tool. It's the idea that we need to connect it with pedagogy. So professional learning in this needs to be, if we don't know a great instructional strategy in the first place, all the technology tools in the world are not going to help us. So we need to be able to marry that to instructional strategies and talk about how that impacts students from a learning standpoint and a pedagogical one.
Good deal. Good deal. I appreciate your comment there that we don't have to discard the strategies like reciprocal teaching that we've, you know, perhaps been using for years. You know, if those can be adapted. So the what are we already doing column, I think is a critical one to not overlook there.
Yeah. The other day I was working with a school district that I'm between day two and day three, I used the flipped model. So I sent them an article on reciprocal teaching from Doug Fisher and Nancy Fry. They had to read it between day two and day three. And then at day three, I put them in Zoom breakout rooms and each person had to take one of the responsibilities from reciprocal teaching and talk about the article. So those are the ways that we can use those strategies in our remote experience.
Wait, did you have them teach each other about reciprocal teaching using reciprocal teaching? Did I pick up on that correctly?
I did. Yeah. We need to double down, but yeah, like, you know, Doug Fisher and Nancy Fry, they have a great column in educational leadership and it always comes with a video. My mindset now is let's take those strategies, something I would have used in a flipped learning experience at flipped faculty meetings where we could read the column, watch the video at the faculty meeting, and then discuss what that might look like in the classroom. What we need to do is the same exact thing. So I'm using things like the flipped model. I'm using Flipgrid to create a community of learners because I'm getting people to answer a question and then they upload the question and then you've got people that they have to respond to three other people. If we want kids to engage in dialogue, then we use that same sort of technique with our adults. We can't talk at a faculty meeting about what teachers need to do differently if we're not doing it at our faculty meeting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Peter, let me direct your attention now to the chat, and rather than have me pick out questions to pose to you, let's just look through that together. Sure. Do you have that there in your Zoom window?
So I see two of them.
Yeah. Let's see.
Oh, okay. So Eric, what specific do the elements need to be make this effective? Clearly, there's a degree of vagueness at what this doesn't work. Can you give me an example of what this might look like? I'm not sure what that question is referring
to. Yeah, and that was from quite a while ago. There should be quite a few more comments below
that. Can Peter share any resources that summarize what he found in his student surveys? He said kids have very defined ideas about what works. Absolutely. So so I wrote a couple of blogs for Finding Common Ground on this information. But one of the things that happened is that students said what they really liked, common theme among what they really liked, is that they like when their teacher would do virtual live events twice a week. And so you see a lot of places talking about that already, because there were a plethora of kids who came back and said, we haven't seen our teacher in weeks. We only have a link to a Google Classroom. They're like, that's boring. So what we find is that there were students that said, many students who actually said they like things like Zoom meetings or Microsoft Meet, whatever you're going to use, twice a week, because it actually allowed them to see their peers and their teachers. Many of the students actually answered they miss their teachers. And you have to think about it this way, because I think principals need to be able to do the same thing. We're going through a pandemic, and for a while we would watch news and feel very uncomfortable with all the news that was coming in, the number of deaths. So we feel a sense of trauma during this time. What is going to make us feel better? Well, seeing the face of our teacher might make us feel better. Seeing our peers might make us feel better. Seeing our principal might make us feel better. So that's something that is really important, and students actually said so. What they also said is that they liked when teachers uploaded videos just as long as they were short. So if we're talking under 10 minutes, I remember when TED Talks were like the quickest thing ever because they were 16 minutes or 15 minutes long. Now, if you get up over 7 minutes, people are like, no, this is too long. I have to like sit back and wait. So they like shorter videos that are going to help them. And I had a guy actually tell me that he works with all autistic children. And he was saying that they really liked being able to, some of the kids on the autism spectrum really like 2D videos where they could actually watch a video over and over again to get an understanding. I used to be a struggling learner. So seeing something several times is actually very beneficial to me as well. What they said they did not like, and they were very clear about it, is that they didn't like when teachers uploaded, and many teachers did this, 1 hour videos where the teacher just taped themselves, talked at the screen, and maybe used a PowerPoint at the same time. So they did that voiceover, and then they uploaded that to Google and said, that is going to be today's class. Students did not like that whatsoever. They were tired of review work. Part of that is because I worry that, or I think that, because we're in such a crisis mode, that we use the same review sheets that we used a few months ago. Review is not a bad thing if we're doing surface to deep to transfer level learning, say project-based learning over a review component. But that's not what necessarily was being done. So students were really tired of all the review in the same old way. And they also were very clear that they didn't like when teachers just uploaded assignments into Google Classroom and that was it, because they didn't get feedback from those. So anytime we can have a visual where we can see each other, and the interesting thing about this, because I was actually coaching some people earlier today that I work with in Massachusetts, there were teachers that said that there were students that got on Zoom, but they would turn their video off. There are a couple of different ways to look at this. If I'm teaching a mind-numbingly boring lesson and my students have turned the video off, then they're probably playing Fortnite at the same time I'm talking. However, if I am actually an engaging teacher and I have created great relationships with my kids, and they turn the video off, that might be because the student doesn't want you seen into their house because they might be embarrassed about where they live. That is one of the reasons why I saw, with six reasons why students weren't showing up to online learning, I wrote bedlam but no bedroom, because there are kids that might have multiple families in one house. So there are a variety of reasons that we need to be empathetic about for why that might be taking place.
Good phrase to help people, distinguish between those. Well, let's talk a little bit about if we could, these kind of hybrid schedules that we're all talking about. I'm seeing a lot of discussion of maybe an A group and a B group, where some students come Monday and Wednesday, and some students come Tuesday and Thursday, and everybody's at home on Friday. If we I think virtually everybody is being asked to plan for a scenario like that, among others, right now. If we were to use the program logic model approach, take us through some of your initial thinking, and anyone feel free to jump in the comments here. So for communicating to parents, for communicating to staff members, for taking that input and the feedback that we've received so far, how do we use this to kind of lay out something like an alternating hybrid schedule?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to understand that most of what you read about the hybrid model, especially if you go on the pandemic pages, No matter what you come up with, there will be people who will not be happy with part of it. And we need, and I don't mean that in a sarcastic way, I mean that in a real way. We need to understand that, because we're never going to make everybody happy, nor do we usually make people happy. Even if we say everybody's coming back in person, there will be people that are nervous about that because there is no cure for the coronavirus. So under needs, we would have to decide on what hybrid model you're specifically talking about. Now, Madeline Will talked about things like the phased reopening or a multi-track system. So what you would do under needs is you might say something like, you know, we need to be able to bring back 10, the typical number that I'm seeing right now is fewer than 10 kids in each class. And that is going to be your needs. And then you start to need, you need to be able to look at what are going to be your inputs from then on. Does that mean that if you are supposed to have fewer than 10 kids in each classroom, then your inputs are going to be articles like this that are research-based, because she interviewed people from national organizations, superintendents, teachers, and all that stuff. And that's where you would plug in those kind of articles and those models. What does that look like? If I'm interested in something that she says, like, you know, a year-round schedule or a cyclical lockdown strategy, then you're going to want to find articles that are specific to that. When it comes to activities, you really need to talk about what are the activities that are going to fit into that model. What can you possibly do during that time? So it means really focusing on one of those models that you think would work the best in your situation, and then start talking about what do the activities look like. I can give you some examples where this is concerned. So I took Madeline's article and I wrote a blog yesterday that I'll post on Sunday about what do these strategies or this these six ways mean for teachers. Well, it really comes down to three things. Teachers are either going to be teaching in person. Florida, for example, is a state that said, an article just came out, that the kids are going to come back in the fall. All the kids are going to come back in the fall. So those teachers in those districts need to understand that they are an in-person classroom. What does that mean under activities? It means that you're really going to have to talk about what does social distancing look like if you're even going to do that, wearing masks, those kind of stuff. What are the activities you're going to be able to do with the students in an in-person session? To be quite honest with you, you could even say if in-person is going to be the deal I'm going to be working with, then activities going to be about what did we learn from this whole experience? Less is more. We don't have to do as many activities as that we were doing. So you can talk about that. When you look at something like besides in-person, you're going to have the hybrid approach, meaning that many of these mean that teachers are going to find themselves in an in-person session and they're going to find themselves in a remote session. One of the things that I added to the blog that will come out is that when we're looking at that hybrid approach, I think we can look at models like the flipped model, because the flipped model will be a great way that if I know I'm going to be a hybrid teacher, then perhaps what I'm doing under activities and I put down a flipped model, it means that I'm going to send something home with students that they can start to get some surface level knowledge of, and then we can go deeper into it when they come back into the classroom. That would be under the activities section. We could also flip that, and we could say that the in-person session is where we're going to do direct instruction, and then when the students go home, they're going to do project-based learning. So those are two different ways to look at hybrid. That would go under the activity section. Under outputs is where you start talking about when you are going to start doing that, meaning in September, in August, or whatever, or during week one, or during week two. That's where you start to plug that in. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that's definitely getting us there. And I'll resist my own tendency to do all the talking here. Let me open this up to everyone who is joining us. We've got a fantastic group here. So I'm just going to keep an eye on the chat here. And Peter, if you want to respond to anything you see there, or again, if anybody would like to come on camera, feel free to ask and I'll promote you to a panelist and you can do that.
So I'm finally seeing where I wasn't looking at the appropriate chat section. So this is really good. I actually, I found that. So Yes, Heather Bell Williams, I believe we have to be pushing our jurisdictions to define essential learnings, essential outcomes. You know, that's actually, Heather, something that you can put under needs, right? You can put, we need to focus on essential learnings and essential outcomes. And then the inputs would actually be, what are the resources you're using to help people understand what those essential learnings and essential outcomes are? The activities are the things you're going to be doing to focus on those. Outputs are obviously where you're going to start, and then ultimate will be impact. How did those essential learnings and essential outcomes have a positive impact on student learning? So that's just a quick way of looking at that one. I personally like Fisher and Fry's visible learning for literacy. I think when Fisher, Fry, and Hattie wrote visible learning for literacy, it's been a that was a fantastic book. That was actually the first in the series. Beth, I have found what looked to be some excellent resources from the Center for Transformative Teaching and Learning at St. Andrews. See, those are all the resources that you can use to actually plug that in. You know, and that's the thing. Like I was with John in the UK before that first week of March. And I was going through the program logic model, something that he has himself looked at. And we talked about the benefit of the simplistic sort of five, I don't want to call it five steps because it's not really five steps, but these five different areas, and then plug in what we need to really be able to do. So, C. Stratton, Wisconsin Center's Continuous Improvement and Equitable Learning, would you recommend developing different logic models, one for each simultaneously occurring approach? Yes, personally I would, because I think that, so I've looked at in-person, blended, and then the remote experience. And those are really the three options for teachers. I think it would be really important to be able to separate those among using a program logic model for each one. So that's definitely a great question.
I think Heather was on one of your recent Corwin webinars, Peter, and I think she wanted to ask a question about classroom walkthroughs. So Heather, I'll turn it over to you.
Sure.
Thanks, Justin. You mentioned, Peter, lots, well, in your book about walkthroughs, and you referenced it earlier. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on if we're all moving to or most of us are moving to at least a hybrid model where there's going to be a great deal more remote teaching than we've had in the past. What kind of framework do you see, or what kind of language do you see in a framework around what would good walkthroughs look like in this new context? What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about that because early on I saw some things on Facebook where people were just not very happy at the idea of teacher observations done remotely or learning walks done remotely. The thing I'm always going to go back to, Heather, and I wrote about it in Instructional Leadership, is that anytime you're going to go and do a learning walk sort of document, whatever you want to use is, you know, some people use a checklist, other people use different things. I would never move forward with one of those without working with a group of teachers to discuss it. One of my biggest things that I've talked about for a while is a common language and common understanding. We often have a common language, but we don't have a common understanding. So when we even talk about learning walks in the best of time, learning walks mean different things to different people. So being able to sit down and going through a cycle of learning to talk about what does a proper remote learning walk look like? What are the things we should be looking for? What does the dialogue look like? What should students be doing? I think that's something that needs to be developed with students. I have not seen anything that has blown me away to say that's the tool you should be using. And quite honestly, I've been asked to create one with people I've worked with. And I sometimes worry about doing that because I worry that somebody would take that and just use it without ever talking to their teachers about it. I think that dialogue is essential to be able to, because this is our reality. Our reality is we're going to have to do remote learning walks. And that's something I do. You know, when I'm working with the districts, I have a teacher teaching remotely. And then we start talking about what did you see? What feedback would you give her? What, you know, what kind of conversations would you have about this? So we go through the activities of doing that in a workshop, because I think the reality is in the fall, we're going to be there. And here's the thing too. I get the Maslow before Bloom. Like, people have been saying that for a long time. But now I think we're in a place where we need to talk about Maslow and Bloom, right? We need to be able to talk about the soul. I've always focused on social emotional learning, both from being a elementary school teacher and principal to starting to write the blog in 2011. But the academic piece is something we have to be talking about. And what struck me is that when I was coaching some of the leaders I work with, they were saying, well, we just have to get through the next month, but we're worried about the fall. I'm like, if you're so worried about the fall, then don't get through the next month. Like, we have to focus on these discussions now. In fact, when I'm going to post the blog on Sunday on what is it going to look like when we reopen, I know, I mean, I live in upstate New York. They're ending school this week. So some of my former teachers are not going to be very happy with me that on the following Sunday, I'm saying what it will reopening look like. But the reality is, we didn't have that when this all happened in March. Now we have a couple of months to be able to talk about what could this look like in the fall. And we don't want to lose that. We want to be able to focus on what will good remote learning look like? What did we learn that we have been doing that was beneficial? And how do we as leaders support teachers through that kind of dialogue?
Thank you. That's awesome.
Okay, good.
Well, Peter, I want to be respectful of your time, and I want to ask everyone, if you wouldn't mind in the chat, if you could put in some of your takeaways from this conversation. You know, there are a lot of things to think about, both in terms of logic models and in terms of hybrid and virtual learning and several of the other issues that we've touched on today. So if you wouldn't mind putting in some of your takeaways in the chat. Peter, one of my takeaways really is around simplicity and clarity. You know, if we're going to get a large group of people from, you know, multiple different stakeholder groups to kind of coalesce around a given plan, it's so critical that we be clear, that we communicate that in a straightforward way, what exactly that's going to look like. Yeah, Matt is saying something similar. Keep it simple, be very focused and clear on what we're teaching. Let's see, it doesn't have to be complex, Brian says. Final thoughts, Peter, as you review what's coming in the chat and think back on our conversation today?
Yeah, I think for me, it's always about how do we create dialogue in schools that are going to have a focus on learning? And I saw somebody had mentioned the whole idea of common language, you know, when I said common language and common understanding. That is one of the biggest downfalls that we experience both in person and from a remote experience. I often focus on things like the growth mindset. Actually, Carol Dweck, I'm going to be interviewing in a few weeks. And growth mindset's one of those things that everybody knows it, but the reality is they don't use it correctly. And she's even had to clarify her work. Multiple intelligences, Howard Gardner had to do the same thing. Carol Ann Tomlinson around differentiated instruction. So regardless of what it is you want to focus on from a current needs standpoint, just make sure you have the common language and common understanding so you know you're talking in the same direction.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as instructional leaders, when we're kind of waiting to figure out what we can do in terms of walkthroughs, you know, I'm a big fan of getting into classrooms 500 times a year. That's something that that Heather has done for, I think, 4 years running now and that we promote at the Principal Center. But in the meantime, you know, while we're still figuring out what that's going to look like, I've replaced that hashtag in my mind with 500 conversations. You know, we need to be having these conversations about what this is going to look like, making sure that we're not just using common vocabulary, but that we have a common understanding. I think that is a tremendously, you know, simple but incredibly important thing for us to do.
Students about it is important. You know, when I did the surveys of students, they gave me a lot of great information. And when I wrote a blog, the first blog on it, Will Richardson actually posted it on LinkedIn, which I was very honored by. But one of the things that struck me is somebody said, wow, out of all the blogs, this is the first one I've ever seen that have actually talked to students about what they need. I was thinking, that's just such a weird thing for me. We need to make sure that when we're having these conversations about what the fall should look like, that we need to be able to make sure we're getting great information from students, or else just one more time, they're going to feel like their voices haven't been heard.
Yeah, I think especially of the students who maybe stop showing up, you know, when students maybe are there and are starting to disengage. I think we need to figure out, yeah, why that is. And as you said, what worked for them, what they liked, what they wanted more of, and what they wanted to see happen differently. Well, Peter, thank you so much for your time today. I know you've got to run, but if people want to get in touch with you and maybe talk about doing some work together, where's the best place for them to connect with you?
Sure. They can find me on Twitter at Peter M. DeWitt. And then my email address is pmdewitt518@gmail.com. So I'll say that one more. PM as in Michael, pmdewitt518@gmail.com. And thanks, Justin. I always appreciate talking to you.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. I greatly appreciate it. We will post this recording on the same page. So the link you clicked to be here today, we'll have the recording just as soon as we can get it uploaded. Thank you to everyone for engaging in this conversation. We probably could have scheduled this to be 3 hours long and not run out of things to talk about, but very much appreciate everyone being here and setting aside the time. I know there's just tons going on and tons of planning to do. So thank you for your engagement and for everyone participating in the chat and asking questions. And Peter, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you, everyone, for joining. I appreciate it.